31. While on his way to Pensacola to visit his mother, Popeye was arrested in Birmingham for the murder of a policeman in a small Alabama town on June 17th of that year. He was arrested in August. It was on the night of June 17th that Temple had passed him sitting in the parked car beside the roadhouse on the night when Red had been killed. Each summer, Popeye went to see his mother. She thought he was a night clerk in a Memphis hotel. His mother was the daughter of a boarding housekeeper. His father had been a professional strikebreaker hired by the Street Railway Company to break a strike in 1900. His mother at that time was working in a department store downtown. For three nights, she rode home on the car beside the motorman's seat on which Popeye's father rode. One night, the strikebreaker got off at her corner with her and walked to her home. "Won't you get fired?" she said. "By who?" the strikebreaker said. They walked along together. He was well-dressed. "Them others would take me that quick. They know it, too."
"Who would take you?"
"The strikers. I don't care a damn who was running the car, see? I'll ride with one as soon as another. Sooner if I could make this route every night at this time." She walked beside him.
"You don't mean that," she said.
"Sure I do." He took her arm. "I guess you'd just as soon be married to one as another the same way." "Who told you that?" he said. "Have them bastards been talking about me?"
A month later, she told him that they would have to be married.
"How do you mean, have to?" he said.
"I don't dare to tell them. I would have to go away. I don't dare."
"Well, don't get upset. I'd just as lief. I have to pass here every night anyway."
They were married. He would pass the corner at night. He would ring the footbell. Sometimes he would come home. He would give her money. Her mother liked him. He would come roaring into the house at dinner time on Sunday, calling the other clients, even the old ones, by their first names. Then one day he didn't come back. He didn't ring the footbell when the trolley passed. The strike was over by then. She had a Christmas card from him, a picture with a bell and an embossed wreath in gilt, from a Georgia town. It said, "The boy's trying to fix it up here. But these folks awful slow. We'll maybe move on until we strike a good town. Ha, ha." The word strike was underscored. 3 weeks after her marriage, she had begun to ail. She was pregnant then. She did not go to a doctor because an old Negro woman told her what was wrong. Popeye was born on the Christmas day on which the card was received. At first, they thought he was blind. Then they found that he was not blind, though he did not learn to walk and talk until he was about 4 years old. In the meantime, the second husband of her mother, an undersized, snuffy man with a mild, rich mustache, who pottered about the house, he fixed all the broken steps and leaky drains and such, left home one afternoon with a check signed in blank to pay a $12 butcher's bill. He never came back. He drew from the bank his wife's $1,400 savings account and disappeared. The daughter was still working downtown while her mother tended the child. One afternoon, one of the clients returned and found his room on fire. He put it out. A week later, he found a smudge in his wastebasket. The grandmother was tending the child. She carried it about with her. One evening, she was not in sight. The whole household turned out. A neighbor turned in a fire alarm, and the firemen found the grandmother in the attic, stamping out a fire and a handful of excelsior in the center of the floor, the child asleep in a discarded mattress nearby.
"Them bastards are trying to get 'em," the old woman said. "They set the house on fire."
The next day, all the clients left. The young woman quit her job. She stayed at home all the time.
"You want to get out and get some air," the grandmother said.
"I get enough air," the daughter said.
You could go out and buy the groceries, the mother said. You could buy them cheaper.
We get them cheap enough. She would watch all the fires. She would not have a match in the house. She kept a few hidden behind a brick in the outside wall. Popeye was 3 years old then. He looked about one, though he could eat pretty well. A doctor had told his mother to feed him eggs cooked in olive oil. One afternoon, the grocer's boy, entering the areaway on a bicycle, skidded and fell. Something leaked from the package.
"It ain't eggs," the boy said. "See?"
It was a bottle of olive oil.
"You ought to buy that oil in cans, anyway," the boy said. "You can't tell no difference in it. I'll bring you another one. And you want to have that gate fixed. Do you want I should break my neck on it?"
He had not returned by 6 o'clock. It was summer. There was no fire, not a match in the house.
"I'll be back in 5 minutes," the daughter said.
She left the house. The grandmother watched her disappear. Then she wrapped the child up in a light blanket and left the house. The street was a side street just off a main street where there were markets, where the rich people in limousines stopped on the way home to shop. When she reached the corner, a car was just drawing into the curb. A woman got out and entered a store, leaving a Negro driver behind the wheel. She went to the car.
"I want a half a dollar," she said.
The Negro looked at her.
"A which?"
"A half a dollar. The boy busted the bottle."
"Oh," the Negro said.
He reached in his pocket.
"How am I going to keep it straight with you collecting out here? Did she send you for the money out here?"
"I want a half a dollar. He busted the bottle."
"I reckon I better go in then," the Negro said.
"Seem like to me you folks would see the folks got what they buy, folks that have been trading here long as we is."
"It's a half a dollar," the woman said. He gave her a half dollar and entered the store. The woman watched him. Then she laid the child on the seat of the car and followed the Negro. It was a self-serve place where the customers moved slowly along a railing in single file. The Negro was next to the white woman who had left the car. The grandmother watched the woman pass back to the Negro a loose handful of bottles of sauce and ketchup.
"That'll be a dollar and a quarter," she said.
The Negro gave her the money. She took it and passed them and crossed the room. There was a bottle of imported Italian olive oil with a price tag.
"I got 28 cents more," she said.
She moved on, watching the price tags, until she found one that said 28 cents. It was 7 bars of bath soap. With the 2 parcels, she left the store. There was a policeman at the corner.
"I'm out of matches," she said.
The policeman dug into his pocket.
"Why didn't you buy some while you were there?" he said.
"I just forgot it. You know how it is, shopping with a child." "Where is the child?" the policeman said.
"I traded it in," the woman said.
"You ought to be in vaudeville," the policeman said. "How many matches do you want? I ain't got but 1 or 2.
"Just 1," the woman said. "I never do light a fire with but 1.
"You ought to be in vaudeville," the policeman said. "You'd bring down the house."
"I am,"
the woman said.
"I bring down the house."
"What house?" he looked at her.
"The poor house?" "I'll bring it down," the woman said. "You watch the papers tomorrow. I hope they get my name right."
"What's your name? Calvin Coolidge?"
"No, sir. That's my boy."
"Oh, that's why you had so much trouble shopping, is it? You ought to be in vaudeville.
Will 2 matches be enough?"
They had had 3 alarms from that address, so they didn't hurry. The first to arrive was the daughter. The door was locked, and when the fireman came and chopped it down, the house was already gutted. The grandmother was leaning out an upstairs window through which the smoke already curled.
"Them bastards," she said. They thought they would get them. But I told them I would show them. I told them so.
The mother thought that Popeye had perished also. They held her, shrieking, while the shouting face of the grandmother vanished into the smoke and the shell of the house caved in. That was where the woman and the policeman carrying the child found her. A young woman with a wild face, her mouth open, looking at the child with a vague air, scouring her loose hair slowly upward from her temples with both hands. She never wholly recovered. What with the hard work and the lack of fresh air, diversion, and the disease, the legacy which her brief husband had left her, she was not in any condition to stand shock, and there were times when she still believed that the child had perished, even though she held it in her arms, crooning above it. Popeye might well have been dead. He had no hair at all until he was 5 years old, by which time he was already a kind of day pupil at an institution, an undersized, weak child with a stomach so delicate that the slightest deviation from a strict regimen fixed for him by the doctor would throw him into convulsions. "Alcohol would kill him like strychnine," the doctor said, "and he will never be a man, properly speaking. With care, he will live some time longer, but he will never be any older than he is now." He was talking to the woman who had found Popeye in her car that day when his grandmother burned the house down, and at whose instigation Popeye was under the doctor's care. She would fetch him to her home in afternoons and for holidays, where he would play by himself. She decided to have a children's party for him. She told him about it, bought him a new suit. When the afternoon of the party came and the guests began to arrive, Popeye could not be found. Finally, a servant found a bathroom door locked. They called the child, but got no answer. They sent for a locksmith, but in the meantime the woman, frightened, had the door broken in with an axe. The bathroom was empty. The window was open. It gave onto a lower roof, from which a drainpipe descended to the ground. But Popeye was gone. On the floor lay a wicker cage in which two lovebirds lived. Beside it lay the birds themselves, and the bloody scissors with which he had cut them up alive. 3 months later, at the instigation of a neighbor of his mother, Popeye was arrested and sent to a home for incorrigible children. He had cut up a half-grown kitten the same way. His mother was an invalid. The woman who had tried to befriend the child supported her, letting her do needlework and such. After Popeye was out, he was let out after 5 years, his behavior having been impeccable, as being cured, he would write to her 2 or 3 times a year, from Mobile and then New Orleans and then Memphis. Each summer he would return home to see her, prosperous, quiet, thin, black, and uncommunicative in his narrow black suits. He told her that his business was being night clerk in hotel, that, following his profession, he would move from town to town, as a doctor or a lawyer might. While he was on his way home that summer, they arrested him for killing a man in one town and at an hour when he was in another town killing somebody else. That man who made money and had nothing he could do with it, spend it for, since he knew that alcohol would kill him like poison, who had no friends and had never known a woman and knew he could never. And he said, "For Christ's sake," looking about the cell in the jail of the town where the policeman had been killed. His free hand, the other was handcuffed to the officer who had brought him from Birmingham, finicking a cigarette from his coat. "Let him send for his lawyer," they said, "and get that off his chest." "You want a wire?" "Nah," he said, his cold, soft eyes touching briefly the cot, the high, small window, the grated door through which the light fell. They removed the handcuff. Popeye's hand appeared to flick a small flame out of thin air. He lit the cigarette and snapped the match toward the door. "What do I want with a lawyer? I never was in. What's the name of this dump?" They told him. "You forgot, have you?"
He won't forget it no more, another said. Except he'll remember his lawyer's name by morning, the first said.
They left him smoking on the cot. He heard doors clash. Now and then he heard voices from the other cells. Somewhere down the corridor, a Negro was singing. Popeye lay on the cot, his feet crossed in small, gleaming black shoes.
For Christ's sake, he said.
The next morning, the judge asked him if he wanted a lawyer.
What for? He said. I told him last night I never was here before in my life. I don't like your town well enough to bring a stranger here for nothing.
The judge and the bailiff conferred aside.
You'd better get your lawyer, the judge said.
All right, Popeye said.
He turned and spoke generally into the room.
Any of you ginnies want a one-day job?
The judge rapped on the table. Popeye turned back, his tight shoulders lifted in a faint shrug, his hand moving toward the pocket where he carried his cigarettes. The judge appointed him counsel, a young man just out of law school.
And I won't bother about being sprung, Popeye said. Get it over with all at once.
You wouldn't get any bail from me anyway, the judge told him.
Yeah, Popeye said.
All right, Jack, he told his lawyer. Get going. I'm doing Pensacola right now.
Take the prisoner back to jail, the judge said. His lawyer had an ugly, eager, earnest face. He rattled on with a kind of gaunt enthusiasm while Popeye lay on the cot, smoking, his hat over his eyes, motionless as a basking snake, save for the periodical movement of the hand that held the cigarette. At last he said,
Here, I ain't the judge. Tell him all this.
But I've got...
Sure. Tell it to them. I don't know nothing about it.
I wasn't even there.
Get out and walk it off.
The trial lasted one day. While a fellow policeman, a cigar clerk, a telephone girl testified, while his own lawyer rebutted in a gaunt mixture of uncouth enthusiasm and earnest ill judgment, Popeye lounged in his chair, looking out the window above the jury's heads. Now and then he yawned. His hand moved to the pocket where his cigarettes lay, then refrained and rested idle against the black cloth of his suit, in the waxy lifelessness of shape and size like the hand of a doll. The jury was out 8 minutes. They stood and looked at him and said he was guilty. Motionless, his position unchanged, he looked back at them in a slow silence for several moments.
Well, for Christ's sake, he said.
The judge rapped sharply with his gavel. The officer touched his arm.
I'll appeal, the lawyer babbled, plunging along beside him. I'll fight them through every court.
Sure, Popeye said, lying on the cot and lighting a cigarette. But not in here. Beat it now. Go take a pill.
The district attorney was already making his plans for the appeal.
It was too easy, he said. He took it. Did you see how he took it? Like he might be listening to a song he was too lazy to either like or dislike, and the court telling him on what day they were going to break his neck. Probably got a Memphis lawyer already there outside the Supreme Court door now, waiting for a wire. I know them. It's them thugs like that that have made justice a laughing stock, until even when we get a conviction, everybody knows it won't hold.
Popeye sent for the turnkey and gave him $100 bill. He wanted a shaving kit and cigarettes.
Keep the change and let me know when it's smoked up, he said.
I reckon you won't be smoking with me much longer, the turnkey said. You'll get a good lawyer this time.
Don't forget that lotion, Popeye said. Ed Pinard.
It had been a gray summer, a little cool. Little daylight ever reached the cell, and a light burned in the corridor all the time,
falling into the cell in a broad, pale mosaic, reaching the cot where his feet lay. The turnkey gave him a chair. He used it for a table. Upon it the dollar watch lay, and a carton of cigarettes and a cracked soup bowl of stubs, and he lay on the cot smoking and contemplating his feet while day after day passed. The gleam of his shoes grew duller, and his clothes needed pressing because he lay in them all the time, since it was cool in the stone cell. One day the turnkey said, "There's folks here says that deputy invited killing. He done 2-3 mean things folks knows about." Popeye smoked, his hat over his face. The turnkey said, "They might not have sent your telegram. You want me to send another one for you?" Leaning against the grating, he could see Popeye's feet, his thin black legs motionless, merging into the delicate bulk of his prone body. And the hat slanted across his averted face, the cigarette in one small hand. His feet were in the shadow of the turnkey's body where it blotted out the grating. After a while, the turnkey went away quietly. When he had 6 days left, the turnkey offered to bring him magazines, a deck of cards. "What for?" Popeye said. For the first time, he looked at the turnkey. His head lifted. In his smooth, pallid face, his eyes round and soft as those prehensile tips on a child's toy arrows. Then he lay back again. After that, each morning, the turnkey thrust a rolled newspaper through the door. They fell to the floor and lay there, accumulating, unrolling, and flattening slowly of their own weight in diurnal progression. When he had 3 days left, a Memphis lawyer arrived. Unbidden, he rushed up to the cell. All that morning, the turnkey heard his voice raised in pleading and anger and expostulation. By noon, he was hoarse, his voice not much louder than a whisper.
"Are you just gonna lie here and let—" "I'm all right," Popeye said. "I didn't send for you. Keep your nose out."
"Do you want to hang? Is that it? Are you trying to commit suicide? Are you so tired of dragging down Jack that you, the smartest—"
"I told you once, I've got enough on you."
"You? To have it hung on you by a small-time JP? When I go back to Memphis and tell them, they won't believe it."
"Don't tell them, then."
He lay for a time while the lawyer looked at him in baffled and raging unbelief.
"Them darn hicks," Popeye said. "Jesus Christ." "Beat it now," he said. "I told you. I'm all right."
On the night before, a minister came in. "Will you let me pray with you?" he said.
"Sure," Popeye said. "Go ahead. Don't mind me."
The minister knelt beside the cot where Popeye lay smoking. After a while, the minister heard him rise and cross the floor, then return to the cot. When he rose, Popeye was lying on the cot smoking. The minister looked behind him, where he had heard Popeye moving, and saw 12 marks at spaced intervals along the base of the wall, as though marked there with burned matches. 2 of the spaces were filled with cigarette stubs laid in neat rows. In the 3rd space were 2 stubs. Before he departed, he watched Popeye rise and go there and crush out 2 more stubs and lay them carefully beside the others. Just after 5 o'clock, the minister returned. All the spaces were filled save the 12th one. It was 3/4 complete. Popeye was lying on the cot.
"Ready to go?" he said.
"Not yet," the minister said. "Try to pray," he said. "Try."
"Sure," Popeye said. "Go ahead."
The minister knelt again. He heard Popeye rise once and cross the floor and then return.
At 5:30, the turnkey came. "I brought," he said. He held his closed fist dumbly through the grating. "Here's your change from that hundred you never... I brought... It's $48," he said. "Wait, I'll count it again. I don't know exactly, but I can give you a list. Them tickets..." "Keep it," Popeye said, without moving. "Buy yourself a hoop." They came for him at 6. The minister went with him, his hand under Popeye's elbow, and he stood beneath the scaffold praying, while they adjusted the rope, dragging it over Popeye's sleek, oiled head, breaking his hair loose. His hands were tied, so he began to jerk his head, flipping his hair back each time it fell forward again, while the minister prayed, the others motionless at their posts with bowed heads. Popeye began to jerk his neck forward in little jerks. "Psst," he said, the sound cutting sharp into the drone of the minister's voice.
"Psst."
The sheriff looked at him. He quit jerking his neck and stood rigid, as though he had an egg balanced on his head.
"Fix my hair, Jack," he said.
"Sure," the sheriff said. "I'll fix it for you,"
springing the trap. It had been a gray day, a gray summer, a gray year. On the street, old men wore overcoats, and in the Luxembourg Gardens, as Temple and her father passed, the women sat knitting in shawls, and even the men playing croquet played in coats and capes. And in the sad gloom of the chestnut trees, the dry click of balls, the random shouts of children had that quality of autumn, gallant and evanescent and forlorn. From beyond the circle with its spurious Greek balustrade, clotted with movement, filled with a gray light of the same color and texture as the water which the fountain played into the pool, came a steady crash of music. They went on, past the pool, where the children and an old man in a shabby brown overcoat sailed toy boats, and entered the trees again and found seats. Immediately an old woman came with decrepit promptitude and collected 4 sous. In the pavilion a band in the horizon blue of the army played Massenet and Scriabin, and Berlioz like a thin coating of tortured Tchaikovsky on a slice of stale bread, while the twilight dissolved in wet gleams from the branches onto the pavilion and the somber toadstools of umbrellas. Rich and resonant, the brasses crashed and died in the thick green twilight, rolling over them in rich, sad waves. Temple yawned behind her hand. Then she took out a compact and opened it upon a face in miniature, sullen and discontented and sad. Beside her, her father sat, his hands crossed on the head of his stick, the rigid bar of his mustache beaded with moisture like frosted silver. She closed the compact, and from beneath her smart new hat, she seemed to follow with her eyes the waves of music, to dissolve into the dying brasses, across the pool and the opposite semicircle of trees, where at somber intervals, the dead, tranquil queens in stained marble mused, and on into the sky lying prone and vanquished in the embrace of the season of rain and death.